Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. Monday through Thursday, we talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend the Catholic faith. On Friday, we talk about whatever I want to talk about, because it's Free for All Friday. And today I want to talk about hidden themes and allegories in classic novels. So you probably first encountered this in high school when you read George Orwell's book, Animal Farm. So your English teacher assigns it. You read Animal Farm and you think, oh, it's a story about animals revolting, taking over a farm where the farmer had previously been neglecting them, mistreating them. And then they try to run the farm themselves. They become crooked. They become corrupt. And then everything ends up falling apart. And it's even worse than they were before. And you read it and you're like, oh, wow, this is kind of a sad, depressing story. Then your teacher blows your mind and tells you, actually, this is not really about a bunch of pigs running a farm. It's about the Soviet Union. It's about communist Russia. I don't know if they teach Animal Farm in public schools anymore. I would be skeptical whether they actually do that or not. They should. And if you haven't read Animal Farm, or your junior high student or high school student has not read Animal Farm, they should read it because, one, it's a great exercise in learning about English literature and sifting out themes and allegories. And it's also a great introduction to history, especially the history of socialism, communism, and gives an eye-opening look into what happens when people have these lofty promises, but then everything ends up falling apart and you get even worse results. You get tragic and horrifying results. So if you have a high school student, I would recommend give them Animal Farm, then give them my book, Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Because I have an entire section in there talking about how socialism was promoted in the Soviet Union in the early part of the 20th century. Then it becomes full-fledged communism, and it ends in some of the worst humanitarian disasters, crimes against humanity that have ever taken place. A lot of people know about the Holocaust, for example, but they don't know about the Holodomor, which is Ukrainian for murder by starvation, when Stalin purposely withheld food to starve 6 million Ukrainian farmers in 1932, 1933. The deportations that happened in 1933 under Stalin, you had people sent, there were 6,000 people that were sent to this little island in Siberia that eventually ended up being called Cannibal Island. You don't need much of an imagination to figure out why it ended up being called Cannibal Island. But Animal Farm is a great introduction both to that history and to the use of allegory, because I love Animal Farm as a story, because the farmer represents Tsar Nicholas, who had neglected his people and then ends up being overthrown by Lenin. And so you have the pigs. At first, you've got a pig who seems decent enough, a guy named Old Major, who kind of represents Marx and Lenin. And they try to set things right. And they have these commandments that, you know, humans, two legs bad, four legs good. Animals don't sleep in beds. They don't drink alcohol. All animals are equal. But then when the other animals like Napoleon and Snowball take over, who represent Stalin and Trotsky, they do things to their own advantage and they take advantage. They change the rules. They say, oh, well, you can't sleep in a bed with sheets because the pigs are now sleeping in beds. Or all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. That's the most famous altered commandment that becomes their propaganda. All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others, which shows in communist systems that you can have everyone's supposed to be equal. But strangely enough, the leaders and those who have connections to the leaders always turn out fine, even when other people end up starving. So that would be Animal Farm and the allegory there. You're probably familiar with that. You may not be as familiar with the allegory, the alleged allegory in The Wizard of Oz or The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. I remember reading this book back in junior high, actually. So when I was in the 7th and the 8th grade, I spent a lot of time in the library at lunch. I played Oregon Trail, Sim City, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? And then I just read books. I got really into reading classic books. And so I remember in the shelf seeing this big, thick book, The Wizard of Oz, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And I thought, oh, I've seen the movie, but I wonder if the book is different. And the book is somewhat different from the film. So the book was written, it was published in the year 1900. It became a Broadway play in 1901. Then it became a movie produced with Judy Garland as Dorothy in 1939. And a lot of us, a lot of people have only seen the film, just think that it's a fantasy story about a young girl from Kansas taken to the wonderful world of Oz, and she just wants to find her way home, follow the yellow brick road. But in 1964, a critic, Henry Littlefield, published an article saying that the original novel, The Wonderful World of Oz, and there's a bunch of follow-up spin-off novels from that, like the story goes on and on and on. I think Dorothy has to end up going to see the Witch of the South, and she has to do a whole bunch of other stuff, whereas they just abruptly ended in the film. Littlefield said that the book was actually representative of late 19th century economic policy, namely the debate over the gold standard and bimetallism, which is, should we be pegged to the gold standard, or should we use both gold and silver as the standard? So here's an article, and it does a good job of pointing out where all the characters and everything involved seem to have these sorts of connections. So it says, Frank Baum's book was penned in 1900 following unrest in the agricultural arena, farmers, due to the debate over gold, silver, and the dollar standard. Remember, we're starting in a Kansas farmer trying to make their way. The tornado represents the economic upheaval at the time. You had bank runs, you had panics, currency being devalued. So Dorothy represents every man, the naive, innocent American farmers trying to figure out what in the heck is going on. So Dorothy represents traditional values. The Scarecrow is the American farmer who wants to do something, but they're not quite smart enough to figure out what they need to do. The Tin Man represents the workers, so he would represent industry that has been frozen and stagnated because of this, hence he needs the oil in order to move again. The Cowardly Lion would represent William Jennings Bryan. William Jennings Bryan was a very populist political candidate. He ran for president multiple times and never succeeded. And then he later ended up in the Scopes Monkey Trial. That was the trial about the teaching of evolution in Tennessee, challenging the law prohibiting the teaching of evolution in schools. And William Jennings Bryan was the prosecutor in the case. And everyone was like, oh, William Jennings Bryan, I'm so glad you're here. People loved him. He was a populist celebrity to them. And he acted as the prosecutor in the trial. I remember in high school, I was a bit of a character in high school, and I had a great history teacher, and I would sometimes just, I don't know if you call it prank the class, but I remember once they were covering William Jennings Bryan, the gold standard, and so I barged in on the class dressed up as a 19th century gentleman, and I carried a big cross painted yellow, and I said, "You shall not crucify mankind on a cross of gold." And then my teacher said, "Oh my gosh, everyone, it's William Jennings Bryan protesting the bimetal standard." I said, "That's right. That's right. And I'll be back in 30 years for the Scope Monkey Trial." And then I just disappeared away. In high school, I more just wanted to have fun. I was off to a free for all Friday where I talk about my high school antics, because it was just fun. It was just a lot of fun. So the Cowardly Lion represents Bryan, who in Baum's interpretation is someone who actually was not brave enough to be able to challenge the standard at his time and compromised. So at the time, William Jennings Bryan was the official standard bearer of the silver movement and the unsuccessful Democratic presidential candidate of 1896. In the original story, Dorothy's slippers were made of silver, not ruby, implying that silver was the populist solution to the nation's economic woes, because it makes sense that in the 1939 film they went with ruby slippers instead of silver shoes, because it's in Technicolor. They want to really show off the color that they're using the movie with. Toto, so the yellow brick road is the gold standard. Toto the dog are the prohibitionists who are collaborating with the silverites, so their partners. The Wicked Witch of the West is William McKinley. And the Wizard of Oz is Mark Hanna, who is the chairman of the Republican Party, who made promises he could not keep. Obviously, Oz, the Wizard of Oz, O-Z, is an abbreviation for ounce. So the Wizard of Oz could be read as the Wizard of Ounces, trying to use the gold standard alone rather than just bimetallism, which would be gold and silver. It said, It should be noted that before 1873, the U.S. dollar was defined as consisting of either, so what made the dollar a dollar, what it was worth, was either 22 and a half grains of gold or 371 grains of silver. This set the legal price of silver in terms of gold at 16 to 1. So you need 16 times the amount of silver to equal gold. And the country was on a bimetal gold-silver standard. Since both metals had other uses than just coinage, you can make jewelry out of gold, you can make important parts or machines, you can use it for other stuff than just for currency. Rational people would buy the cheaper metal and take it to the mint to coin. That provided a natural stabilizing arbitrage. With the 1873 Coinage Act, however, the silver dollar was omitted, effectively shifting the country from a bimetallic to a gold standard alone. Hence, William Jennings Bryan saying that this punishes poor people who might have done better in being able to choose either gold or silver based on what was going to benefit them at the time. Hence, he gave a very famous speech about labor being crucified on a cross of gold. Other countries soon followed this shift. Tons of silver were unloaded. The market price of silver in terms of gold rose from 16 to 1 to 40 to 1. The result was that the dollar was now linked to a metal, gold, that was getting scarcer and scarcer. Particularly hurt by these events were the net debtors, among them the farmers, because they had to face a rising real value of their debts combined with declining agricultural prices. And so this led to things like the Sherman Silver Purchase Act in 1890, the Panic and Depression in 1893. Oh, and Bryan gave the Cross of Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention in 1896, but he was still unable to secure the election and win as a result. And so then that's 1896, 1900, Baum publishes The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. It all comes together. I think this is a very plausible theory that is what The Wizard of Oz is about. So I hope that was helpful to you. I'll give you one other example of a novel that has a theme that many people probably overlook, and that would be Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, the 1818 novel Frankenstein. The full title actually is Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, published in 1818. A lot of us, once again, it's hard when we try to critically analyze these older works because a lot of times we think of the movies. So Wizard of Oz, we think of the film. Frankenstein, we think of the later film adaptations, which is a big green guy who kind of grunts and has bolts in his neck. It's alive! When actually, the monster in Frankenstein is not called Frankenstein. Frankenstein is the name of the doctor, is the name of the scientist who brings him to life. And he's not a dullard who walks around, you know, and grunts. He actually learns French. He's trying to understand his parentage. The novel, so Victor Frankenstein is one of the characters who creates the monster, which is called Frankenstein's monster. Later, it ends up being called Frankenstein. But this article here at The Conversation says that one of the major themes of the novel seems to be about the negative effects of not having a mother. And we think about it, that's what makes the monster a monster, is that, look, here is life that is created, a humanoid life that is created by a man, apart without a woman involved, without a mother, without that maternal involvement. Even today, with all of our technology, in vitro fertilization, NICU units, we cannot bring a new human being to maturity without the body of a woman. So even, you know, we still have not been able to do that 200 years after Mary Shelley's novel. So the author, Mary Shelley, wonders what would happen if you divorce the creation of life from its natural maternal foundation. So it says in this article that the fact that this theme is present, you can see that mothers in Frankenstein in the novel are quite short-lived. Victor Frankenstein's mother, an orphan, dies of scarlet fever. Victor's cousin and wife, while nursing Victor's cousin and wife, Elizabeth, cousins in quotation marks, related to her actual role in the story. While on their honeymoon, Victor's wife, Elizabeth, is killed by the monster. Justine, the Frankenstein's housekeeper, is falsely convicted of the murder of Victor's younger brother, who also grows up motherless. Frankenstein's most dramatic instance of motherlessness is the monster itself, a human being created by a man alone. Reflecting on this feat, Victor remarks that no father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as he would deserve of the new race of creatures he sought to create. Victor had not done away entirely with the need for maternity. For though he had selected the creature's features as beautiful, the moment he beholds it stirring, he recoils. The beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart. The idea here is that Victor Frankenstein creates the monster, brings it to life, and he's recoils at it, and he can't love it. Whereas, you know, think of that expression, a face only a mother could love, that a mother always loves her children, no matter who they are, because she has that intense maternal bond with them. So I'll leave a link to the description here talking. It has more details in here about some of the themes that are involved. But I think that's also, and of course, a lot of works are going to have multiple themes peppered throughout. Another one that you might miss if you had to read Lord of the Flies, for example, in when you're in high school and you thought it was just about a bunch of kids trapped on an island who end up becoming savage, you know, become savages in quotation marks. They are savage with one another. The point here is that the author is making, it's an ironic commentary on the idea that British nobility is supposed to be enlightened and gentlemanly and civilized, quote unquote, not like the supposed savages they would meet in foreign lands. And yet you have these British schoolboys, once they're on an island, they become that which the British always thought they were better than. The boys, at least the boys who live, spoiler alert, though the novel's been around for a long time, spoiler alert, the boys are rescued at the end, a British sailor from, it's a military ship. They see them, they come to rescue them. They see what the boys have become and their violence towards one another. But then he looks back awkwardly at the military vessel, the destroyer, the ship that he was on that brought him to the island. And he looks back awkwardly at that, thinking maybe they are not really as civilized as they think they are. So, hey, I included a little bonus one in there, Lord of the Flies as well. I hope that was helpful for you all. Thank you so much. And hey, I hope you all have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.